London. The Last Blunder. For several days after the sinking, Wilson said nothing about it in public. He stuck to his routines. He golfed on the Saturday morning after the attack, took a drive that afternoon, went to church on Sunday morning. During a conversation in his study, Wilson told his secretary, Joe Tumulty, that he understood his cool response might trouble some people. If I pondered over those tragic items that daily appear in the newspapers about the Lusitania, I should see red in everything, and I am afraid that when I am called upon to act with reference to this situation, I could not be just to anyone. I dare not act unjustly, and cannot indulge my own passionate feelings. Sensing that Tumulty did not agree, Wilson said, I suppose you think I am cold and indifferent and little less than human, but my dear fellow, you are mistaken, for I have spent many sleepless hours thinking about this tragedy. It has hung over me like a terrible nightmare. In God's name, how could any nation calling itself civilized purpose so horrible a thing? Wilson believed that if he went then to Congress to ask for a declaration of war, he would likely get it. But he did not think the nation was truly ready for that kind of commitment. He told Tumulty, "Were I to advise radical action now, we should have nothing, I am afraid, but regrets and heartbreaks." In fact, apart from a noisy pro-war faction led by former President Teddy Roosevelt, much of America seemed to share Wilson's reluctance. There was anger, yes, but no clear call to war, not even from such historically pugnacious newspapers as the Louisville Courier-Journal and Chicago Tribune. In Indiana, newspapers serving smaller communities urged restraint and support for the president, according to one historian's study of Indiana's reaction to the disaster. The state's 6- and 8-page dailies and the weekly journals were practically of one mind in their hope for peace. Petitions arrived at the White House counseling caution. The Tennessee State Assembly voted a resolution expressing confidence in Wilson and urging the state's residents to refrain from any intemperate acts or utterances. The Louisiana legislature voted its support as well and warned that the crisis at hand calls for coolness, deliberation, firmness, and precision of mind on the part of those entrusted with the power of administration. The students of Rush Medical College in Chicago weighed in, all signing a petition expressing confidence in the sagacity and patience of our president, and urging him to continue his policy of neutrality. Dental students at the University of Illinois took time out to do likewise. German popular reaction to the sinking of the Lusitania was exultant. A Berlin newspaper declared May 7th the day which marked the end of the epoch of English supremacy of the seas, and proclaimed, "The English can no longer protect trade and transport in their own coastal waters. Its largest, prettiest, and fastest liner has been sunk." Germany's military attaché in Washington told reporters that the deaths of the Americans aboard would at last show the nation the true nature of the war. "America does not know what conditions are," he said. "You read of thousands of Russians or Germans being killed and pass it over without qualm. This will bring it home to you." Wilson kept silent until Monday evening, May 10th, when he traveled to Philadelphia to give a previously scheduled speech before 4,000 newly minted citizens. He had seen Edith that afternoon, and by the time he reached Philadelphia was still roiled in the emotional aftersea of that encounter. In his speech, he talked of the importance of America as a force for instilling peace in the world, and of the need for the nation to stand firm even in the face of the Lusitania tragedy. He used an outline, not a fixed text, and improvised as he went along, not the best approach, given his emotional state. "There is such a thing as a man being too proud to fight," he told his audience. "There is such a thing as a nation being so right that it does not need to convince others by force that it is right." These were lofty sentiments, but that phrase, "too proud to fight," struck a dull chord. America did not want to go to war, but being too proud to fight had nothing to do with it. A pro-war Republican, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, called it probably the most unfortunate phrase that Wilson had ever coined. Wilson told Edith he had spoken while in an emotional haze caused by his love for her. In a letter composed Tuesday morning, he wrote, "I do not know just what I said at Philadelphia. As I rode along the street in the dusk, I found myself a little confused as to whether I was in Philadelphia or New York, because my heart was in such a whirl from that wonderful interview of yesterday and the poignant appeal and sweetness of the little note you left with me. But many other things have grown clear in my mind." All that Tuesday, Wilson worked on a protest he planned to send to Germany about the Lusitania. Typing on his Hammond portable, he sought to find the right tone, firm and direct, but not bellicose. By Wednesday evening, he was done. He wrote to Edith, "I have just put the final touches on our note to Germany, and now turn, with what joy, to talk to you. I am sure you have been by my side all evening, for a strange sense of peace and love has been on me as I worked." Wilson sent the note over the objection of Secretary of State Bryan, who felt that to be truly fair and neutral, the United States should also send a protest to Britain, condemning its interference in trade. Wilson declined to do so. In his note, he mentioned not just the Lusitania, but also the Falaba and the death of Leon Thrasher, the bombing of the Cushing, and the attack on the Gulf Light. Citing what he called the sacred freedom of the seas, he described how submarines, when used against merchant vessels, were by their nature weapons that violated many sacred principles of justice and humanity. He asked Germany to disavow the attacks, to make necessary reparations, and to take steps to ensure that such things did not happen in the future. But he was careful also to note the special ties of friendship that had long existed between America and Germany. Wilson's protest, the so-called First Lusitania Note, was the initial salvo in what would become a 2-year war of paper, filled with U.S. protests and German replies, made against a backdrop of new attacks against neutral ships and revelations that German spies were at work in America. Wilson did all he could to keep America neutral in action and in spirit, but Secretary Bryan did not think he tried hard enough and resigned on June 8, 1915. His resignation brought universal condemnation, with editors comparing him to Judas Iscariot and Benedict Arnold. The Goshen, Indiana News-Times said, "The Kaiser has awarded the Iron Cross for less valuable service than that rendered by Mr. Bryan." In a letter to Edith Galt, Wilson himself described Bryan as a traitor. He replaced him with the department's number 2 man, Undersecretary Robert Lansing, who by this time had come to long for war. Wilson had cause for cheer, however. In a letter dated June 29, 1915, Edith at last agreed to marry him. They wed on December 18, 1915, in a simple ceremony at the White House. Late that night, the couple set out on their honeymoon, traveling by private rail car to Hot Springs, Virginia. They had chicken salad for a late supper. As the train pulled into the station early the next morning, Wilson's Secret Service man, Edmund Starling, happened to look into the rail car's sitting room and, as Starling later wrote, saw a figure in top hat, tailcoat, and gray morning trousers standing with his back to me, hands in his pockets, happily dancing a jig. As Starling watched, Wilson, still oblivious to his presence, clicked his heels in the air and sang, "Oh, you beautiful doll, you great big beautiful doll." Germany's U-boat campaign waxed and waned, in step with the rising and falling influence of factions within its government that favored and opposed submarine warfare against merchant ships. Kaiser Wilhelm himself expressed a certain repugnance for attacks on passenger liners. In February 1916, he told Fleet Commander Admiral Scheer, "Were I the captain of a U-boat, I would never torpedo a ship if I knew that women and children were aboard." The next month, Germany's most senior advocate of unrestricted warfare, State Secretary Alfred von Tirpitz, resigned in frustration. This brought a sympathy note from an odd quarter, Britain's former First Sea Lord, Jackie Fisher. "Dear old Terps," he wrote. He urged Tirpitz to cheer up and told him, "You're the one German sailor who understands war. Kill your enemy without being killed yourself. I don't blame you for the submarine business. I'd have done the same myself, only our idiots in England wouldn't believe it when I told them. Well, so long." He signed off with his usual closing, "Yours till hell freezes, Fisher." That June 1916, the Kaiser issued an order forbidding attacks against all large passenger ships, even those that were obviously British. He went on to order so many restrictions on how and when U-boat commanders could attack ships that the German Navy, in protest, suspended all operations against merchant vessels in British waters. But the Lusitania remained a point of conflict. President Wilson's protests failed to generate a response he deemed satisfactory, much to the delight of Britain's Director of Naval Intelligence, Blinker Hall, who argued that any delay in resolving the Lusitania situation was advantageous to the Allied cause. Kapitänleutnant Schwieger did his part to worsen relations between America and Germany. On September 4, 1915, in the midst of a patrol during which he sank 10 steamships and one four-masted bark, he torpedoed the passenger liner Hesperian, killing 32 passengers and crew. The Hesperian was clearly outbound on its way to New York, and thus unlikely to be carrying munitions or other contraband. Among its cargo was the corpse of a Lusitania victim, Francis Stevens, a wealthy Canadian at last being transported home to Montreal. Wilson won re-election in 1916. He played golf nearly every day, often with the new Mrs. Wilson. They even played in snow. Secret Service man Starling painted the golf balls red to improve visibility. They routinely took drives through the countryside, a pastime Wilson adored. Marriage buoyed his spirits and eased his loneliness. Like the previous Mrs. Wilson, Edith became a trusted counselor who listened to drafts of his speeches, critiqued his various notes to Germany, and now and then offered advice. Outside the White House, Wilson's many notes to Germany and their replies became the target of wry humor, as when one editor wrote, "Dear Kaiser, in spite of previous correspondence on the subject, another ship with American citizens on board has been sunk. Under the circumstances, we feel constrained to inform you, in a spirit of utmost friendliness, that a repetition of the incident will of necessity require the dispatch of another note to Your Majesty's most estimable and peace-loving government." As late as December 1916, Wilson believed he could still keep America neutral, and further, that he might himself be able to serve as a mediator to bring about a peace accord. He was heartened, therefore, when that winter Germany stated it might consider seeking peace with Britain under certain conditions. Britain dismissed the overture out of hand, describing it as a German attempt to declare victory. But to Wilson, it offered at least the hope that future negotiations could take place. Germany's ambassador to America, Count Johann Heinrich von Bernstorff, reinforced Wilson's optimism, signaling that Germany was indeed willing to engage in discussions toward peace. But Bernstorff tended to be more optimistic than facts warranted, and possessed only a limited grasp of a new and dramatic change in his own government's thinking. In Germany, a paradoxical shift was underway. Even as its leaders seemed to be maneuvering toward peace, the camp within the government that favored all-out submarine warfare gained ground. These were military officials who now sought authority to sink all merchant ships entering the war zone, neutral or otherwise, even American vessels. The shift was driven in part by the enthusiasm of the German public, who, dismayed by the carnage of the trenches, had come to see the U-boat as a miracle weapon, a Wunderwaffe, that if deployed for total war, would quickly force Britain to her knees. This coincided with a fundamental change in German naval thinking, in which Schwieger and U-20 played an important role. Throughout the fall of 1916, Schwieger had continued his exemplary performance as a submarine commander, sinking ship after ship. But early that November, he ran into trouble. While returning from a 3-week patrol in the western approaches, his boat ran aground in fog about 20 feet from the Danish shore. He radioed for assistance. The response was overwhelming. Admiral Scheer ordered destroyers to the scene to attempt to pull U-20 loose and dispatched an entire battle squadron, cruisers and battleships, to provide protection. Still, U-20 remained mired. Schwieger was ordered to destroy the boat to keep it from falling into enemy hands. He exploded 2 torpedoes in the bow. If his intent was to obliterate the boat, he failed. The bow was mangled, but the rest of the boat and its gun remained intact, embedded in the sand to a depth of about 15 feet and fully visible from the shore. Meanwhile, in London, Room 40 began receiving wireless intercepts that indicated something extraordinary was taking place. The Room 40 log noted great excitement and activity. The Admiralty dispatched a submarine to the scene, whose commander found 4 battleships and managed to torpedo 2 of them, damaging both, sinking neither. The episode proved to have a crystallizing effect on German naval strategy. At first, Kaiser Wilhelm upbraided Admiral Scheer for putting so many ships at risk on behalf of one submarine. But Scheer countered that the U-boat force had supplanted the high seas fleet as the primary offensive weapon of the German Navy. The fleet, hiding in its bases while ostensibly waiting for the great battle, had achieved nothing. Henceforth, Scheer told Wilhelm, the fleet will have to devote itself to one task, to get the U-boats safely out to sea and bring them safely home again. Scheer argued that U-20 was especially important because if the Royal Navy had been allowed to destroy or capture the U-boat that had sunk the Lusitania, this would be glad tidings for the British government. He told Wilhelm that if submarine crews were to maintain their daring, their ardor, they needed full assurance that they would not be abandoned if they encountered difficulties. To us, Scheer declared, every U-boat is of such importance that it is worth risking the whole available fleet to afford it assistance and support. By this point, Germany's U-boat fleet had achieved a level of strength that at last gave it the potential to become a truly imposing force. Where in May 1915 the Navy had only 30 U-boats, by 1917 it had more than 100, many larger and more powerful than Schwieger's U-20, and carrying more torpedoes. With this robust new fleet now ready, the pressure to deploy it to the fullest grew steadily. A German admiral, Henning von Holzendorf, came up with a plan so irresistible it succeeded in bringing agreement between supporters and opponents of unrestricted warfare. By turning Germany's U-boats loose and allowing their captains to sink every vessel that entered the war zone, Holzendorf proposed to end the war in 6 months. Not five, not seven, but six. He calculated that for the plan to succeed, it had to begin on February 1, 1917, not a day later. Whether or not the campaign drew America into the war didn't matter, he argued, for the war would be over before American forces could be mobilized. The plan, like its territorial equivalent, the Schlieffen Plan, was a model of methodical German thinking, though no one seemed to recognize that it too embodied a large measure of self-delusion. Holzendorf bragged, "I guarantee upon my word as a naval officer that no American will set foot on the continent." Germany's top civilian and military leaders converged on Kaiser Wilhelm's castle at Pless on January 8, 1917, to consider the plan, and the next evening Wilhelm, in his role as supreme military commander, signed an order to put it into action, a decision that would prove one of the most fateful of the war. On January 16th, the German Foreign Office sent an announcement of the new campaign to Ambassador Bernstorff in Washington, with instructions that he deliver it to Secretary Lansing on January 31st, the day before the new campaign was to begin. The timing was an affront to Wilson. It left no opportunity for protest or negotiation, and came even as Bernstorff was promoting the idea that Germany really did want peace. Wilson was outraged, but chose not to see the declaration itself as sufficient justification for war. What he did not yet know was that there was a second, very secret message appended to the telegram Bernstorff had received, and that both telegrams had been intercepted and relayed to Blinker Hall's intelligence division in the old Admiralty building in London, which by now oversaw a second and singularly sensitive component of Room 40's operations, the interception of diplomatic communications, both German and, incidentally, American. The first of Hall's men to grasp the importance of the second telegram was one of his top codebreakers, Lieutenant Commander Nigel de Grey. On the morning of January 17, 1917, a Wednesday, Hall and another colleague were attending to routine matters when de Grey walked into the office. DID, he began, using the acronym for Director of Intelligence Division, "do you want to bring America into the war?" "Yes, my boy," Hall answered. "Why?" De Grey told him that a message had come in that was rather astonishing. It had been intercepted the day before, and De Grey had not yet managed to read the entire text, but what he had deciphered thus far seemed almost too far-fetched to be plausible. Hall read the partial decrypt three or four times in silence. "I do not remember a time when I was more excited," he wrote. But just as quickly, he realized that the remarkable nature of the message presented a challenge. To disclose the text right away would not only put the secret of Room 40 at risk, but also raise questions about the credibility of the message, for what it proposed was certain to raise skepticism. The telegram was from Germany's Foreign Secretary, Arthur Zimmermann, written in a new code that was unfamiliar to Room 40. The process of rendering its text in coherent English was slow and difficult, but gradually the essential elements of the message came into view, like a photograph in a dark room bath. It instructed Germany's ambassador in Mexico to offer Mexican President Venustiano Carranza an alliance, to take effect if the new submarine campaign drew America into the war. Make war together, Zimmerman proposed. Make peace together. In return, Germany would take measures to help Mexico seize previously held lands, lost territory, in Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. Hall had no doubt as to the telegram's importance. This may be a very big thing, he told de Grey, possibly the biggest thing of the war. For the present, not a soul outside this room is to be told anything at all. And that included even Hall's superiors in the Admiralty. Hall hoped he could avoid revealing the telegram altogether. There was a chance that Germany's declaration of unrestricted U-boat warfare by itself would persuade President Wilson that the time for war had come. Hall's hopes soared on February 3, 1917, when Wilson broke off diplomatic relations with Germany and ordered Ambassador Bernstorff to leave. But Wilson stopped short of calling for war. In a speech that day, Wilson stated that he could not believe Germany really intended to attack every ship that entered the war zone, and added, "Only actual overt acts on their part can make me believe it even now." Hall realized the time for action had come, that he had to get the telegram into American hands, but at the same time protect the secret of Room 40. Through a bit of skullduggery, Hall managed to acquire a copy of the telegram as it had been received in Mexico from an employee of the Mexican Telegraph Office, thereby allowing Britain to claim that it had obtained the telegram using conventional espionage techniques. On February 24, 1917, Britain's Foreign Secretary formally presented a fully translated copy of the telegram to U.S. Ambassador Page. Wilson wanted to release the text immediately, but Secretary Lansing counseled against it, urging that they first confirm beyond doubt that the message was real. Wilson agreed to wait. That same day, the news broke that a Cunard passenger liner, the Laconia, had been sunk off the coast of Ireland after being struck by two torpedoes. Among the dead were a mother and daughter from Chicago. Edith Gault Wilson had known them both. Wilson and Lansing resolved to leak the telegram to the Associated Press, and on the morning of March 1, 1917, America's newspapers made it front-page news. Skeptics immediately proclaimed the telegram to be a forgery concocted by the British, just as Lansing and Captain Hall had feared would happen. Lansing expected Zimmerman to deny the message, thereby forcing the United States either to disclose the source or to stand mute and insist that the nation trust the president. But Zimmerman surprised him. On Friday, March 2nd, during a press conference, Zimmerman himself confirmed that he had sent the telegram. "By admitting the truth," Lansing wrote, "he blundered in a most astounding manner for a man engaged in international intrigue. Of course, the message itself was a stupid piece of business, but admitting it was far worse." The revelation that Germany hoped to enlist Mexico in an alliance with the promise of U.S. territory as a reward was galvanizing by itself, but it was followed on Sunday, March 18th, by news that German submarines had sunk three more American ships without warning. To add to the sense of global cataclysm, a popular rebellion sweeping Russia, the so-called February Revolution, had caused the abdication on March 15th of Tsar Nicholas and filled the next day's papers with news of violence in the streets of Russia's then capital, Petrograd. A tectonic shift occurred in the nation's mood. The press now called for war. As historian Barbara Tuchman put it, all these papers had been ardently neutral until Zimmerman shot an arrow in the air and brought down neutrality like a dead duck. Secretary Lansing was elated. "The American people are at last ready to make war on Germany, thank God," he wrote in a personal memorandum in which he revealed a certain bloodlust. "It may take 2 or 3 years," Lansing wrote. "It may even take 5 years. It may cost 1 million Americans. It may cost 5 million. However long it may take, however many men it costs, we must go through with it. I hope and believe that the president will see it in this light." Wilson gathered his cabinet on March 20, 1917, and asked each member to state his views. One by one, each weighed in. All said the time for war had come. Most agreed that, in effect, a state of war already existed between America and Germany. "I must have spoken with vehemence," Lansing wrote, "because the president asked me to lower my voice so that no one in the corridor could hear." Once all had spoken, Wilson thanked them, but gave no hint as to what course he would take. The next day, he sent a request to Congress to convene a special session on April 2nd. He prepared his speech, again typing on his Hammond portable. Ike Hoover, the White House usher, told another member of the staff that, judging by Wilson's mood, "Germany is going to get hell in the address to Congress. I never knew him to be more peevish. He's out of sorts, doesn't feel well, and has a headache." To prevent leaks, Wilson asked Hoover to bring the speech to the printing office in person on the morning of April 2nd. That same day, news arrived that a German submarine had sunk yet another American ship, the Aztec, killing 28 U.S. citizens. Wilson hoped to speak that afternoon, but various congressional processes intervened, and he was not called until the evening. He left the White House at 8:20 p.m. Edith had set off for the Capitol 10 minutes earlier. A spring rain fell, soft and fragrant. The streets gleamed from the ornate lamps along Pennsylvania Avenue. The dome of the Capitol was lit for the first time in the building's history. Wilson's Treasury Secretary and son-in-law, William McAdoo, would later recall how the illuminated dome stood in solemn splendor against the dark, wet sky. Despite the rain, hundreds of men and women lined the avenue. They removed their hats and watched with somber expressions as the president passed slowly in his car, surrounded by soldiers on horseback, as clear a sign as any of what was to come. Hooves beat steadily against the street and gave the procession the air of a state funeral. Wilson arrived at the Capitol at 8:30 to find it heavily guarded by additional cavalry, the Secret Service, post office inspectors, and city police. 3 minutes later, the speaker announced, "The President of the United States." The vast chamber exploded with cheers and applause. Small American flags fluttered everywhere like birds' wings. The tumult continued for 2 minutes before settling to allow Wilson to begin. He spoke in the direct and cool manner that had become familiar to the nation, and that listeners often described as professorial. His voice betrayed no hint of what he was now prepared to ask of Congress. At first he kept his eyes on his text, but as he progressed, he now and then looked up to underscore a point. He described Germany's behavior as constituting, in effect, nothing less than war against the government and people of the United States. He outlined Germany's past efforts at espionage and alluded to the Zimmermann telegram, and he cast America's coming fight in lofty terms. "The world," he said, "must be made safe for democracy." At this, there rose the sound of one man's applause, slow and loud. Senator John Sharp Williams, a Mississippi Democrat, brought his hands together gravely, emphatically, according to a reporter for the New York Times. In the next moment, the idea that this was the centerpiece of Wilson's speech, and that it encapsulated all that America might hope to achieve, suddenly dawned on the rest of the senators and representatives, and a great roar filled the room. Wilson's remarks gained force and momentum, warning of many months of fiery trial and sacrifice ahead. He declared that America's fight was a fight on behalf of all nations. To such a task we can dedicate our lives and our fortunes, everything that we are and everything that we have, with the pride of those who know that the day has come when America is privileged to spend her blood and her might for the principles that gave her birth and happiness and the peace which she has treasured. God helping her, she can do no other. Now came pandemonium. Everyone rose at once. Flags waved. Men cheered, whistled, shouted, cried. Wilson had spoken for 36 minutes. He never mentioned the Lusitania by name. He quickly walked from the chamber. 4 days passed before both houses of Congress approved a resolution for war. During this period, as if deliberately seeking to ensure that no American had last-minute doubts, U-boats sank 2 American merchant ships, killing at least 11 U.S. citizens. Congress took so long not because there was any question whether the resolution would pass, but because every senator and representative understood this to be a moment of great significance and wanted to have his remarks locked forever in the embrace of history. Wilson signed the resolution at 1:18 p.m. on April 6, 1917. To Winston Churchill, it was long overdue. In his memoir-like history, The World Crisis, 1916 to 1918, he said of Wilson, "What he did in April 1917 could have been done in May 1915. And if done then, what abridgment of the slaughter, what sparing of the agony, what ruin, what catastrophes would have been prevented? In how many million homes would an empty chair be occupied today? How different would be the shattered world in which victors and vanquished alike are condemned to live?" As it happened, America joined the war just in time. Germany's new campaign of unrestricted submarine warfare had succeeded to an alarming degree, although this had been kept secret by British officials. An American admiral, William S. Sims, learned the truth when he traveled to England to meet with British naval leaders to plan America's participation in the war at sea. What Sims discovered shocked him. German U-boats were sinking ships at such a high rate that Admiralty officials secretly predicted Britain would be forced to capitulate by November 1, 1917. During the worst month, April, any ship leaving Britain had a 1-in-4 chance of being sunk. In Queenstown, U.S. Consul Frost saw striking corroboration of the new campaign's effect. In a single 24-hour period, the crews of 6 torpedoed ships came ashore. Admiral Sims reported to Washington, briefly stated, "I consider that at the present moment, we are losing the war." Just 10 days later, the U.S. Navy dispatched a squadron of destroyers. They set off from Boston on April 24th. Not many of them, just 6. But the significance of their departure was lost on no one. On the morning of May 4th, 1917, anyone standing atop the old head of Kinsale would have seen an extraordinary sight. First, there appeared 6 plumes of dark smoke far off on the horizon. The day was unusually clear, the sea a deep blue, the hills emerald, very much like a certain day 2 years earlier. The ships became steadily more distinct. Wasp-like with their long, slender hulls, these were ships not seen in these waters before. They approached in a line, each flying a large American flag. To the hundreds of onlookers by now gathered on shore, many also carrying American flags, it would be a sight they would never forget, and into which they read great meaning. These were the descendants of the colonials, returning now at Britain's hour of need, the moment captured in an immediately famous painting by Bernard Gribble, The Return of the Mayflower. American flags hung from homes and public buildings. A British destroyer, the Mary Rose, sailed out to meet the inbound warships and signaled, "Welcome to the American colors." To which the American commander answered, "Thank you. I am glad of your company." On May 8th, the destroyers began their first patrols, just a day beyond the 2-year anniversary of the sinking of the Lusitania. Epilogue. Personal Effects. One hot day in July 1916, a harbor pilot walked into the Ship News office in Battery Park in Manhattan and invited a group of reporters to accompany him on a brief voyage by tugboat up the Hudson River to Yonkers, north of Manhattan, where he was to fetch out a ship, that is, guide it downriver to the wider and safer waters of New York Harbor. Ordinarily, this was not a voyage the reporters would be inclined to make, but the day was stifling, and the pilot said the fresh air would do them all good. The reporters, among them the Evening Mail's Jack Lawrence, also brought along a good deal of alcohol, or, as Lawrence put it, liquid sustenance. As their tugboat approached the Yonkers Wharf, the reporters saw that the ship was an old Cunard ocean liner, the Ultonia, docked there to pick up a load of horses for the war. It was a small ship, with one funnel. She looked so smeared and dirty and utterly woebegone that we hardly recognized her, Lawrence wrote. The ship's black hull had been painted gray in haphazard fashion. Much of this had chipped off, giving her a peculiar, spotted appearance. The day was languid, the river calm, and yet the ship moved with the peculiar side-to-side motion. Lawrence had never seen such a thing and found it almost uncanny. This rolling, the pilot explained, was caused by the hundreds of horses within the ship. Sensing movement, all the horses roped to one side of the hull would suddenly rear backward in alarm, causing a slight roll. This, in turn, would startle the horses anew and cause those on the opposite side to step back. The side-to-side roll became more pronounced with each cycle, to the point where the ship looked as if it were being buffeted by a heavy sea. This, the pilot explained, was called a horse storm, and under certain conditions it could bang a ship against its wharf and damage deck rails and boats. As the tugboat pulled up alongside the Ultonia, the ship's cargo doors swung open to admit the pilot. The sun blazed. Inside the darkened hold stood one man, shaded by the overhead door. He looked down at the pilot and reporters. He did not smile. Lawrence recognized him at once. Captain William Thomas Turner. His old blue uniform was soiled and wrinkled, Lawrence wrote, but his cap, bearing the Cunard Line insignia, was still at the familiar jaunty angle. The figure of the man was still erect and commanding. The pilot climbed into the ship. "Glad to see you aboard, sir," Turner told him. "We'll get underway immediately. These horses are raising hell." Turner had been given command of the ship in November 1915, after its regular captain had fallen ill during a stop in France. He had been the only captain available to replace him. Just before Turner left Liverpool to take over command, Cunard's chairman Alfred Booth asked him into his office. Booth began to apologize about assigning Turner to such a modest vessel, but the captain stopped him. "I told him there were no regrets on my part," Turner said. "I would go to sea on a barge if necessary to get afloat again, as I was tired of being idle and on shore while everyone else was away at sea." In December 1916, Cunard reassigned Turner and put him in command of the Ivernia, another passenger ship recommissioned for war duty, though this one carried troops, not horses. Turner was not its master for long. On January 1, 1917, while in the Mediterranean off the island of Crete, the ship was torpedoed and sunk, killing 153 soldiers and crew. Turner survived. The ship had been zigzagging at the time of the attack. Cunard made Turner a relief captain and put him back in charge of the Mauritania, but this was a thin expression of confidence, for the ship was in dry dock. In 1918, Turner was once again compelled to relive the Lusitania disaster when a federal judge in New York opened a trial to determine whether Cunard was liable for the ship's loss. The proceeding combined 70 lawsuits filed by American survivors and next of kin. Here, too, the judge ruled that the sole cause of the disaster was Schwieger's attack, and that he had fired two torpedoes. The final humiliation for Turner came later, with publication of Winston Churchill's book, in which Churchill persisted in blaming Turner for the disaster, and despite possessing clear knowledge to the contrary, reasserted that the ship had been hit by two torpedoes. The old captain, this great little man, as his friend George Ball put it, had survived the sinking of the Lusitania with his pride intact. He'd survived the sinking of the Ivernia, but this new affront hurt him. At 64, when Cunard required captains to retire, Turner left the company and traveled to Australia to try to mend things with his estranged family, but found that life there did not suit him. He returned to England and retired to his home in Great Crosby outside Liverpool to be looked after by his longtime companion, Mabel Every. He kept bees in half a dozen hives that he had built in his yard and harvested the honey they produced. Often in conversation, he would absent-mindedly pick stingers from his arms and shins. Turner was said to be a fundamentally happy man who liked a good pipe now and then. He told stories of the sea, but never the one most people wanted to hear. Captain Turner felt the loss of the Lusitania very much, and seldom mentioned it to anyone, wrote Miss Every. It was this silence that told his friends how heavily the disaster weighed on him. In a reply to a sympathetic female friend in Boston, Turner wrote, "I grieve for all the poor innocent people that lost their lives, and for those that are left to mourn their dear ones lost." But that was all he was willing to say on the subject, he told her. "Please excuse me saying more, because I hate to think or speak of it." At the same time, he was not haunted by the disaster, nor did it leave him depressed and broken, as popular conception might have held. Wrote George Ball, "He was far too strong a character to brood over a matter that was beyond rectification and allow it to worry him to the point of melancholy, a characteristic he never at any time displayed." Turner himself said, in an interview with the New York Times, "I am satisfied that every precaution was taken, and that nothing was left undone that might have helped to save human lives that day." Turner retained his good humor, according to George Ball. Merriment and humor were always prominently observable in his company, and never was he unable to keep all his associates interested and amused. This became more difficult when, in his 70s, cancer infiltrated his colon. "The poor fellow did suffer great agony in the last year of his life," Ball wrote. Turner died on June 24, 1933, at the age of 76. "He died as he had lived," Ball wrote, "full of courage and spirit and without complaint. So passed to the great beyond one of the hardy and able sailors of the old hard school." Turner's niece, Mercedes Desmore, attended the funeral. The captain was buried at a cemetery in Birkenhead, across the Mersey from the Liverpool docks. His name was engraved at the bottom of the family tombstone, along with a brief reference to the Lusitania. A new war came, and on September 16, 1941, a Nazi U-boat torpedoed and sank a British ship, the Jedmore, off the Outer Hebrides, killing 31 of its 36 crew. Among the lost was a 55-year-old able seaman named Percy Wilfred Turner, Captain Turner's youngest son. In April 1917, Kapitänleutnant Walter Schwieger was given command of a new submarine, U-88, larger than U-20, and with twice the number of torpedoes. A few months later, on July 30th, he received the German Navy's highest award, a pretty blue cross with a French name, Pour le Mérite, nicknamed the Blue Max. At the time, he was only the 8th U-boat commander to receive one. His reward for having sunk 190,000 gross tons of shipping. The Lusitania alone accounted for 16% of the total. In London, in the old Admiralty building, Room 40 tracked Schwieger and his new boat through 4 cruises, one of which lasted 19 days. The 4th cruise began on September 5, 1917, and proved to be considerably shorter. Soon after entering the North Sea, Schwieger encountered a British Q-ship, the HMS Stonecrop, one of a class of so-called mystery ships that outwardly looked like vulnerable freighters, but were in fact heavily armed. While trying to escape, Schwieger steered his boat into a British minefield. Neither he nor his crew survived, and the submarine was never found. Room 40 recorded the loss with a small notation in red. Sunk. In Denmark, coastal residents continued to visit the shore where his previous boat, U-20, had run aground, and now and then would climb upon the wreckage, until in 1925 the Danish Navy demolished the remains with a spectacular explosion. By then, the conning tower, deck gun, and other components had been removed. They reside today in a seaside museum in Torsminde, Denmark, on an austere stretch of North Sea coastline. Severed from its base and laced with rust, the conning tower sits on the museum's front lawn with all the majesty of a discarded refrigerator, a forlorn ghost of the terrifying vessel that once hunted the seas and changed history. Captain Reginald Blinker Hall was knighted in 1918 for his work with Room 40, though the work itself was kept secret for decades. He went on to win election to the House of Commons as a Conservative member and remained active in politics through the 1920s. At one point, during a general strike in 1926, the Conservative Party established a temporary newspaper, the British Gazette, and put Hall in charge of personnel. The editor-in-chief was his old boss, Winston Churchill. Circulation soared to 1 million copies a day before the strike ended. Hall retired from politics in 1929 and moved to a home in the New Forest, a lovely terrain of pasture and woods in southern England. He set out to publish a book about Room 40 and his exploits as intelligence chief, but in August 1933, the Admiralty and Foreign Office, sensing a new dark tilt in the world, made clear their displeasure and their wish that the story remain secret. Hall withdrew the manuscript, though his notes and a number of completed chapters reside today in the Churchill Archives in Cambridge, England. In one notation, Hall exalts, "How simple is intelligence." Hall believed that new trouble was indeed soon to come in Europe. He visited Germany and Austria in 1934. Ever the intelligence man, he reported his observations about the National Socialist movement to the government. He also described his experience to a friend in America. "All the young are in the net," he wrote. "Anyone who tried to keep out of being a Nazi is hazed till they change their mind. A form of mass cruelty which exists only in such a country." He added, "It will, sometime soon, be the duty of human beings to deal with a mad dog. When that time comes, your people will have to take their share." When the next war did begin, Hall joined Britain's Home Guard. He became its chief of intelligence. His health, never good, declined as the war progressed. In July 1943, one of his former codebreakers, Claude Sericold, by that point a director of Claridge's Hotel, put him up in one of the hotel's suites so that he could spend his last days in comfort. At one point, a plumber arrived to deal with a problem in the bathroom. In keeping with the dignified character of the hotel, the plumber was dressed in a black suit. Hall said, "If you're the undertaker, my man, you're too early." He died on October 22nd, 1943. Among the passengers who survived, all of whom received from Cunard a lifetime discount of 25%, there were marriages, lifelong friendships forged, and at least two suicides. Rita Jolivet's sister, Inez, a renowned violinist, was not herself a passenger, but her husband was among the lost. She decided she could not live without him, and in late July 1915, shot herself to death. At least two young men who had survived the sinking were subsequently killed in the war. Margaret Mackworth experienced a complex suite of after-effects. Her ordeal had the perverse result of eliminating her long-standing fear of water and substituting an exaggerated terror of being trapped in an enclosure underwater. This fear came to her primarily when she took the train that passed through the Severn Tunnel under the Severn River. It was a journey she had to take often, and every time, she wrote, "I insistently pictured the tunnel giving way, the water rushing in, and the passengers being caught and suffocated and drowned like rats in a trap in the little boxes of carriages." Overall, though, she believed the disaster had made her a better person. She had a new confidence. "If anyone had asked me whether I should behave as I ought in a shipwreck, I should have had the gravest doubts," she wrote. "And here I had got through this test without disgracing myself." She also found, to her surprise, that the experience had eliminated a deep horror of death that she had harbored since childhood. "I do not quite understand how or why it did this," she wrote. "The only explanation I can give is that when I was lying back in that sunlit water, I was, and I knew it, very near to death." The prospect had not frightened her, she wrote. "Rather, somehow, one had a protected feeling, as if it were a kindly thing." Her friend and table mate, Dorothy Connor, went on to join the war effort, working in a canteen in France close to the front. In honor of her help and bravery, the French awarded her the Croix de Guerre. Young Dwight Harris presented his engagement ring to his betrothed, Miss Aileen Cavendish Foster, and they were married on July 2, 1915, in London. The little boy he saved, Percy Richards, reached the age of 40, but killed himself on June 24, 1949. George Kessler, the Champagne King, made good on a pledge he had made during his time in the water, that if he survived, he would devote himself to the care of victims of the war. He established a foundation to help soldiers and sailors blinded in battle. Helen Keller became a trustee, and later gave her name to the organization, which operates today as Helen Keller International. 5 months after the disaster, Charles Laurier wrote a book about his experience, entitled The Lusitania's Last Voyage. It became a bestseller. He continued to sell books, manuscripts, and works of art, and in 1922 filed a claim against Germany with the U.S. Mixed Claims Commission for the value of the lost Thackeray drawings